My name is Paul B., and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And really grateful to be here tonight. You know, it's funny thinking about, like Jewel was talking about, where you come from and where you are. And I was just thinking about how there was a point once where I was in a hotel for 3 days with my brother and a friend. And when we left this hotel suite, it was completely trashed. We were smoking in the room. There wasn't a single, let's say, 3 to 4 square inch plane of flat service available because we had so many cases of beer bottles all everywhere, and there are various bits of paraphernalia around as well. And we just left the room because I thought hotel maids clean hotel rooms, and some of them are a win and some are like this, and at the end of the day it's all a balance. And it was so bad they called the police on us because when they saw the room. And I think about now when I travel a lot, I travel a lot for my work. And, I don't feel good with making sure I've washed all the shaving trimmings out of the sink and making sure all the lights are off. And I thought, what a far distance we've come. I spoke at a conference for work. And serendipity being what it is, it was actually out here past Rock Eagle. Monday through Wednesday, I was here at Lake Oconee. There's a Ritz-Carlton resort out here. And I was speaking at a conference. They called me to come out for what I do. And and I thought, instead of going home, I'm here. I'll stay here for a couple of days. And a friend of mine, Dave G, that I know from the workshop, invited me to stay in with his family and his children and his wife. And he's got a really nice house with some really cool stuff. And they trusted me to work there during the day while they went to school and work. You know, that never would have happened, and nor should it have. And I'm trustworthy to do things like that. And it's just so interesting, the dichotomy of where we can start out and where we end up in the miracles of simplicity that I think come with this. So I always like to start off with a joke, kind of open up. So my favorite one is about a couple of women who like to go drinking. So there's Nancy and Sharon, and they're the best of friends, and they live close to the bars, so they can walk to the bars and drink and then walk home. And so it's a Saturday night. They've had a few too many, and they're sauntering home from their excursion. And Nancy leans over and says, "I've really got to go pee." And her friend says, "Me too, but all the bars are closed, nowhere's open, and I don't think we can make it home." And Nancy said, "Well, what should we do?" And with a keen alcoholic mind, they said, "Well, there's a cemetery over here. Why don't we just duck in there and go, and it won't even matter. Nobody will know. Nobody will see us." So they went in there, and they were relieving themselves. And then it occurred to them they didn't have all the accoutrement necessary to finish such a task. And so Nancy says, "There's no toilet paper." And her friend says, "Yeah, you're right." And so, they improvised. They MacGyvered it, if that's a dated reference for some of you. And Nancy said, "Well, I'm just going to use my underwear." And her friend said, "Well, I'm going to use this ribbon on a wreath against this other tombstone." And they did that, and they returned home. They passed out in their respective beds. Now, their husbands were friends as well, Jim and Bob. Jim calls Bob. He says, "I got to tell you, I'm getting really worried about the girls going out drinking." He said, "I woke up this morning, and I looked over, and Nancy, she came home last night with no underwear on." And his buddy said, "I got to tell you, I'd be concerned if I were you too, but candidly, I think I should be a little more worried. My wife, she had her underwear on, but inside there was a note that said, 'From all of us at the fire department, we're really going to miss you.'" Our book says we make decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. So it's interesting. My mind tells me things that aren't real. My mind interprets reality. My perception is skewed. It's like, there was once a professor of biology, and he was talking about the factual chemistry of the ills of alcohol on organic tissue. And there was this lecture hall full of students. And as he was talking about the particulars of that, he took a beaker filled with ethyl alcohol, and he put in some earthworms. And he set it down, and he proceeded to talk about how alcohol destroys tissue and organic tissue, and going through the breakdown of that based on organic chemistry. And then he later picked up the beaker and held it up to students. And the flesh is just flaying off of these earthworms. And people were just horrified. And he said, do you see my point? And the alcoholic in the back is so excited. And he's like, this is great. As long as I keep drinking, I'll never get worms. So, you know, a lot of times we don't get it, but we're just not wired that way. So, for me, you know, I grew up in Virginia, like Bill said. You know, I was born March 6, 1974, to two parents, and the genes of addiction, you know, were definitely in my family. I had a lot of things that I felt, you know, that really got in the way for me. I've heard others explain, and I can relate to feeling like going through life and feeling like everybody else get their instruction manual of how to live life at birth, and they forgot to hand me mine. And I felt like I just intuitively didn't know how to handle most situations that I was in and trying to figure things out. You know, I've heard people talk about feeling like my skin didn't fit and very uncomfortable most of the time, and I can relate to that. You know, you know, food was my first thing, so I was very heavy as a kid and very self-conscious about that. I have no athletic ability whatsoever, and as boys are kind of coming up, you know, it's one thing to not be good at sports. It's another thing to be embarrassingly bad. Like, I was that. You know, I wet the bed till I was 12 years old, and I just always felt like I was just kind of hiding and very full of shame, right? Guilt says I've done a bad thing, and shame says I am bad, and I always kind of felt less than from the very beginning, for various reasons. And I just know I took my first full drink, and I just felt this warmth cascade over me through my body. I felt okay. The voices in my brain that came from a few places, you know, telling me that, calling me names and cursing and curse words. And I always went through my life feeling like I had giant slugs crawling over rocks in my stomach all the time. And I was just trying to maintain. And when I drank, that stopped. And I felt okay, and I felt warm, and I felt safe. You know, the promises came true for me in that moment. And I felt like I was okay, and I wasn't worried about people, and I wasn't worried about my past or my present or anything, and I felt okay. And I wanted to feel like that all the time, and I didn't know how to do that. And so I started living my life, seeing what that would look like, you know. And I hit 13, and I slimmed down, and I had an experience where I found that women found me attractive, and I'm like, oh, that really, that's a whole other story. But that became a thing for me. So I constantly always needed outside validation to make me feel like I was okay. Because I never really did. You know, one thing that's interesting to me, being in recovery, raise your hand. Let's do this. I'm going to do thumbometer. This is the thumbometer. This is no. This is eh. This is, oh, I can relate. So, thumbometer. If you've ever done this, because I hear people go, hey, you know what it is when you get a few years or you get a lot of years and you start to think, you know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. I don't even want to drink anymore. It's been a while. Maybe I don't have a problem. Anybody? Thermometer? Anybody ever feel like that? I have never once felt like that. And my sobriety date, again, is September 24th, 1997. And you know, what I understand about addiction is that if you're like me, you've got a thing in your brain that says if some is good, more is better, apply to all. And so, see, my life's like whack-a-mole. So anything that gives me a shot of dopamine, the chemistry of the brain, because it's not, a doctor's opinion says, it's not about alcohol or drugs, it says, I like the effect produced by alcohol. I like when I put it in, it's a catalyst for my brain to release something where I feel okay. And I can do that with other stuff that hits that same piece of my brain because the monkey's off my back. But as we know, the circus will always be in town. And so my life's like whack-a-mole. So it's about the alcohol and drug had a bit down for a couple decades, but I got to know, where is this showing up for me? Where is it popping up? I can eat pizza alcoholically. Do you know what I mean? Is it food? Is it sex? Is it exercise? Is it work? Is it my phone? Is it video games? Is it Netflix? The first year my kids had Halloween candy, I thought as a dad you get to eat the candy. Some of the candy anyway. And I sat there, and my kids were in bed, and I'm not scarfing. I'm just leaning over, pick a piece, and watch TV. A couple minutes later, another one. But you do that for 4 or 5 hours, it's going to add up. So stone cold sober, I start feeling like I need to go to the bathroom. And I go into that bathroom and I sit down and I have an extreme vertigo where I cannot stay sitting down on the toilet and I have to get on the floor. This is sober. Hugging a toilet on the floor. Sober. In a cold sweat. And my stomach in knots. It felt like I wanted to die. Found that I had sugar shock. I know there's a medical term for some of you doctors out there know what that is. I don't. And even that doesn't make me alcoholic. You know what really makes me alcoholic? Did the same damn thing next year. Did the same exact thing the next year. While saying that's not going to happen again. I'm saying still eat candy, but I'm not going to have that experience. You know? And I've got stories like that in all those other areas I reference. So I never go, maybe I'm not one of us. Because I go to extremes with things where normal people would not. That has varying levels of consequences. So I know I belong. So the way that I did it, I started drinking in high school, like I think a lot of us do, and then I got to go to college, and I couldn't wait to go to college, because now, man, I was going to be free. And to just sum up my first attempt at college, I went to a little school called Hamden Sydney College in Farmville, Virginia, and I was there for a semester. And to sum all that time up, I just say, if I couldn't eat it, drink it, smoke it, or screw it, I destroyed it. And I was home by Christmas with a 0.6 GPA. And so I said, okay, this plan for life success is not panning out for me. And so my parents, I knew they were going to give me a lot more opportunities. So the men in my family have gone to the Virginia Military Institute for college since 1800s. And I thought, you know what? That's what I need. You know, like in bowling, they put those bumpers up for kids. So when they roll the ball, it'll just paint, no gutter ball. It just goes all the way down. I'm like, I just need that for my life. What would that look like for life? Because that's really what I need. What would that be? And I thought, certainly a military environment would be perfect for me. You know what I mean? It kind of rein me in and really focus me. And so I went to VMI, and I got kicked out of there twice. Because, see, I still didn't realize everywhere you go, you take yourself with you. I just hadn't learned that, you know? And all I did was put myself in an environment where I still wanted to do all those things, but the consequences for getting caught doing those things were far greater than anything I'd experienced to this point, and it was much, much harder to do them. So, you know, it's not glamorous to be drinking cough syrup and looking at a lava lamp, you know what I mean? And so, you know, whatever, when we couldn't get beer and just like, again, you know, have a problem in that environment and ended up doing a lot of crazy things there. But so I got kicked out of there twice. The second time is when it got really bad. It got really bad. I started doing drugs as well, and I try not to get into details, but I will say that I loved to drink. And I like to do drugs that help me drink more and allow me to stay awake longer. So I got to the point where I was staying awake for 3 days at a time. I'd smoke this stuff, and I would just be awake, and I wouldn't be hungry, and I could just drink and drink and drink and drink. And I was doing that in a military college environment. It was really crazy. One point I was home, and then I got to doing hallucinogens as the foundation, and then doing that stuff to be able to drink. But it got unmanageable because, you know, when you run out of that stuff, you know, a lot of times, you know, you can go down looking in the carpet thinking maybe you've dropped some. I mean, relate to that? Carpet farming. And so, but it's bad because on hallucinogens, I remember going down to see if maybe I could find something. But because I was hallucinating, the carpet would be flowing, and I would be mesmerized by the show. And I'm on my hands and knees, and I'm just, like just, and you know, I think with hallucinogens, you lose your frame of reference with how time has passed. The passage of time becomes elusive and deceiving. And I'd be down there, and my knees hurt, and my back is sore, and the heels of my hands are getting tired, and I'm going, what the hell am I doing down here? And I would get up, and there was this real comfortable sofa chair I used to spend 80% of my time in. And I was like, oh, my God. And I look over, I'd see the pipe, and go, oh, yeah, back to another 2 hours. Another 2 hours. So it got pretty bad. But so I went back to school, and I was like, I'm just going to figure this out. So I'm in this military, I'm in a barracks environment doing this kind of stuff. You know, going down, doing things like going to downtown Lexington in my cadet uniform, like to buy illicit drugs at 4 a.m. in these neighborhoods. And, but, you know, and it was getting scary. And I can relate to one day at a time. because I was like, just for today, I can keep this madness going. I know the tide's coming in at some point. I get it. I know this house of cards is going to fall down. But just for today, I can still do this. And this is all I know how to do. It's all I'm really able to do. And it's all I want to do. In a military environment, military school, they have discipline, right? Military is known for discipline. And so the discipline system was set up as such where you got demerits when you didn't behave. So to give you a frame of reference, if you were in a formation and you were waiting and there was an inspection and you didn't shine your shoes, 2 demerits. Okay. If you skip class, that's a big one. It's not like normal college where you miss class. They classified every class as a formation. And anybody with the military background knows you don't miss a formation. So it was a big deal. You got 10 demerits, 1 week of confinement, and 10 hours of marching with your rifle for missing one class. Nobody did it. It wasn't worth it. I was so far off the grid, though, I wasn't doing anything I was supposed to do. Nobody knew where I was most of the time. In fact, Where's Waldo was big at the time. And they told me in the back of the school paper, they had a Where's Bickford, because nobody knew where I was. It was like a joke. And my last semester there, I wasn't going to any classes. I wasn't doing anything. My last demerit period. A demerit period is 28 days. You can get 16 demerits in a 28-day period. Anything over that, you get a penalty towards. My last demerit period, I had 394 demerits. It was so bad when you do anything above a minor infraction, they send you a special report, which means you have to go down to the commandant in your gray-blouse uniform and you salute and you hand him that special report and they'll say, okay, why did you not do the thing you were supposed to do? And the penalty could be low or high. It was a scale. And if you're really good, they dismiss it. Well, you get 48 hours to answer a special once it comes to your room. I had them piling up for weeks. So a guard team member, those are the rats, the first year guys. This guy shows up and he goes, sir, Mr. Bickford. And I went like, what? You know, I've probably been awake for 3 days. I'm just rolling over. And he said, I have a special for you. And I said, that's fine. Just leave it in the box. He said, well, sir, they said if you were here when I got here, I wasn't allowed to leave without you coming with me to come right now. And I went, ugh. So then accountability started really rolling in. And I went home for Thanksgiving furlough, and I told my mom and dad that I was probably going to get kicked out of school and that I was strung out on alcohol and drugs. And I remember my dad just looking at me with such disgust. And I understand I'm not pitying or what have you, but I just was kind of running out of things kind of in my life. And I remember I went back, and instead of going back from Thanksgiving furlough to the school, I had my friend drop me off in this neighborhood where I could drink and do drugs and kind of unmolested. So the deputy commandant calls my parents. They say, your son's AWOL from Thanksgiving furlough. And my mother said, I don't understand. His friend picked him up to go back. Honestly, he told us that he's worried he's going to get kicked out. Deputy commandant said, well, ma'am, actually, we are going to kick him out. We just can't find him to do so. So my poor mother drives 3.5 hours from the Hampton Roads area, Virginia, where I'm from, to Lexington to, like, look for me. She's, like, sleeping in her car, this poor woman. And, you know, I'm trying to be hip, slick, and cool around, you know, the ne'er-do-wells that I was spending my time with at this point. And then somebody's like, I think your mom's outside. I was like, what? And so I'm like, well, that's no bueno. So Daddy dipped out the back, and we went to, like, a motel or something, and I crashed there. But that next day was a big deal. And I got to tell you, I mean, we're having fun talking about this stuff, but I will tell you, I was so far off the grid. I was so out there. I literally couldn't have told you what day of the week it was. If you had a gun to my head, I had a 1 in 7 shot. If I woke up and the sun was on the horizon at my window and my alarm clock said 5:30, I couldn't have told you if it was going up or coming down. I was like Crackula. I didn't like the sun. I just, you know. And I woke up the next day, and I, you know, anytime I was awake, I had to put something in my body. Alcohol, drugs, whatever was left over, and there usually wasn't much, but enough to get me through to get more. And I can remember, You know, I tried to put some of this stuff in my body and it just stopped working. And it was a lonely place to be. And I didn't know what to do at that point. And I walked outside, it was about 7:30 in the morning, to smoke a cigarette and kind of gather myself. And I sat down outside this motel and I saw cars going across Route 11. And across the highway from this motel, there was a Chevron Burger King combination there, like you'll see sometimes along rest stop areas and such. And that shouldn't have been a big deal. I saw people in drive-thru getting breakfast. I saw people pumping gas. That shouldn't have been a big deal. But I'd been so far off the grid of just regular society, it was like I was watching the rituals of an alien culture I didn't understand. And I just felt so lonely and so detached from the human race. You know, and I thought about my dad pretty much disowning me. I knew I was getting kicked out of school. I knew I didn't really have anything going on. And I was horribly, horribly depressed from coming down off all this stuff. And just, I was exhausted from living like a zombie for the last many months. And I had a razor blade. I don't know where I picked this up. I watch a lot of movies. But I remember thinking that, picking up somewhere that if you cut your wrist this way, that's a cry for help. And I'm not minimizing it because that's a big deal. But if you really want to check out, you cut down. And I was ready to cut down. And I don't know why I did this. The only thing I remember thinking was wondering about what was going to be on the other side of the dash on the tombstone. Because I was born March 6, 1974. And I was just curious what was going to be on the other side of the dash on my tombstone about the day I checked out. And the only thing that saved my life was when I picked up my watch, there was a little 4 in the date hand. And December 4th is my mother's birthday. And I thought about my mom sleeping in her car and scared for her son. You know, God opened up a small window because I didn't have the ability to have empathy. I only thought about me. And I thought about you as either if you could do something for me or if you were inconveniencing me. And I was able to think about my mom. And I was able to think about what that would do to my mother if I killed myself on her birthday. And so I said, all right, well, I'm going to do this. I just won't do it today. But that was enough. That's what it took to get me to call her to go home. She says, we're going to get you some help. So I went to detox in Virginia Beach and I met a girl. Woo! I met Nancy. And I got to tell you, I wanted what she had and I was willing to go to any length to get it. I really. And Nancy was a very attractive woman, and you know, I was like, she was like me, you know. I had a lot of shame for the things that I was doing besides drinking. Like, I felt like I'd blow my station, and she was in a similar bent. Came from a, you know, upper middle class family, and did some of the like low rent drugs that I was doing, and liked to drink the way I like to drink. And I thought, clearly God has put this woman in my life for us to support each other on a long journey of recovery, of which we are both starting right now. And so Nancy and I ended up going out. We relapsed twice. And the second time, though, is of note. So we went to an NA convention in January 3rd, 1997 in Virginia Beach. I still have the little badge for it. And I've spent most of my time in AA, done some CA. My first sponsor was CA. But anyway, they do it at the Cavalier Hotel on the Virginia Beach oceanfront every year, still, from my understanding. And it is people at the time, anyway, from all the way from like Pennsylvania to like South Carolina. And there were several hundred people for this conference. And Nancy and I, we were going to do this conference, and we registered and we had a hotel room and we're ready to get our recovery on. And we're sitting in the restaurant having dinner. This should have been a softball. We're having a meal surrounded by people in recovery that are here for this conference. And when the waiter comes over to take our drink order, she says, she qualifies to me, and she goes, well, I know I can't smoke that stuff anymore, but I think I can still drink. I'll take a Jack and Coke. I should have just run. I mean, I was freaking out, too, because I thought, you sat in the same process groups that I did, right? I thought we all had this mutual understanding of all of it. We went through a lot of this stuff together. But, you know, I got to understand, I receive a lot of external validation from women, the way that I am perceived and received by women. And I was like, and I went, I'm not a wimp. If she's going to have a drink, I'm going to have a drink. Very recovery-oriented decision-making. And I said, well, I'll have a Jack and Coke. So we're eating dinner, wearing our badges. So I don't know if we... Oh, it gets better. So So we're finishing, and we have two or three with dinner, maybe four, I don't know. But we wanted to get one for the road so we could mingle. So now we're walking around with tumblers of Jack and Coke at an NA convention with the badges on. And the mixture of reactions we got from people were fascinating. And they all fell into three distinct categories. The first group of people, if I were to group them, looked terrified. Terrified, like, oh my God, we're seeing the face of the disease. And they maybe they were, right? But they really looked scared, like it was contagious. And the second group of people looked mad. People looked like they wanted to take me outside and beat me up. They looked really upset. Like, it made me wonder, do they think I was just some regular patron at the hotel who's like, hey, let's get these badges on and go, like, mess with these people. But, you know, honestly, the third group of reactions we got, while the most minimal, was the funniest to me. Because they would go, nah. Their minds wouldn't let them believe what their nose was telling them because they're like, no one would do that. No one would do that. So clearly my nose is playing tricks because that doesn't happen. That can't happen. That's not a reality that would ever take place. So that was my NA convention with Nancy. Fast forward, we ordered a fifth of Jack Daniels at room service at the hotel. And then we ended up going out somewhere nefarious to do other stuff. And then I came back and I'm drunk and dialing and I'm crying and she stayed and I left and I'm like, I need help. And I'd stayed up all night. I bought a 6-pack of beer coming back to the hotel from where I was at all night. I panged, you know, those little yellow concrete poles at the gas station. I have no idea what purpose they serve. They're about this tall. I hit that with my car going to the gas station to get the beer. And so I go up to the hotel room and I start making phone calls. And I thought, you know what? Paul, you need to, are you going to get this thing or not? You're at this recovery convention. There's all these people here for recovery. You're hurting. Just call downstairs. So I said, all right. And I called downstairs and I'm like, oh, I love this girl and I'm here and I'm drunk. And then I was like, okay, all right, hold on. And so she gave me the phone of this guy. And, you know, it's one of our brethren. Probably X1%er, you know, guy. And he goes, this is Chainsaw. And I thought, oh, God. Okay. I was like, hi, Chainsaw. You know. I was like, Chainsaw, man. I'm hurting, Chainsaw. I've been drinking and doing drugs all night. And I had this girl and I left her at the drug house. And I'm just sad. And I was like, Chainsaw, you got to come get me, man. And he goes, well, the way I was taught in recovery, if you want recovery, you got to come and get it. And I can tell you, there was nothing scarier to me than going, I have not even slept all night, still reeling from alcohol and drugs, going down to a room full of people celebrating recovery that were all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I was terrified. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. You got to come and get me. And he said, no, if you want recovery, you got to come get it. And I was like, okay, well, thanks anyway. You and I will never meet. And so I never met Chainsaw. But that was my exchange. It's funny how things happen. I spoke at the Roanoke Men's Workshop a couple years ago, their Thursday night, kind of their pre-speaker thing, and Billy in Tennessee came to me afterwards, and I think they're both in here now, but said, we knew Chainsaw. He helped a lot of guys. And so it's so neat in this program how things can come full circle with that sort of thing. So he's at the big meeting in the sky. God bless him. But I wasn't getting it. And then something really bad happened. My dad was in a car accident where he shot through the window of his car. He shattered his pelvis and he landed in a pile on the highway. And a Nightingale helicopter came down. They picked him up and they carried him to the hospital. And the last words I had said to him at that point was he was kicking me out of the house because I had this thing where I was lying to my parents. I said, yeah, you know, it's okay. At AA, we drink non-alcoholic beer after meetings. So I was not going to meetings. I was going out drinking, coming home, saying, no, I did AA. I was just, and that's okay. This is our thing. And it was very clear that I was not progressing in any sort of recovery. And my dad said, I want you out of the house when I get home. And I told him to go to hell. And he got in a car accident and almost died. He ended up being in the hospital for over a year. My mother, every day when he was in a coma the first few months and they were doing a blood drive and they didn't know if he was going to make it, would go to the hospital. And she would just beg me. She would cry on my shoulder, please, 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 I can't handle you and him. We don't know if your dad's going to make it. and I was still drinking and doing drugs. And it wasn't that I didn't care. It was that I couldn't care. It was basic behaviorism. I knew that when she cried to me that if I hugged her like this and said it's okay, she would leave so I could keep. And I treated their house like a pawn shop, too, because I'd long since been cut off. I was a kid that got kicked out of college. And so, she never knew what she'd come home to. And finally, she said, I'm not doing this anymore. She said, we have a friend, family friend that went to treatment down in Atlanta at a place called Talbot. And you can either go there or you can leave my house. And so I came to Talbot. And I didn't even want to get sober. I just didn't know what else to do. And I didn't want to be on the street. And I spent 6 months in a 90-day program. Somebody can catch that. I spent 6 months in a 90-day program at Talbot Recovery. Well, you know, I relapsed 2 months in at the Gold Club, and they frown on that at Talbot Recovery. Well, I had a great family week. I went out to celebrate 2 months in. And a lot of you are like, what's a Gold Club? Ask your sponsor. It's a gentleman's club. And meet a bunch of the other young guys, because we're there with, like, professional athletes. My roommate was a billionaire biochemist, and I'm like, I'm just some kid that got kicked out of college that can make people laugh. Like, I don't know what's going on. And a lot of us were like, we're different. And so, you know, it's a different thing for us. How are we going to, you know, build a life like these other guys do if we can't, you know, cut some corners? And I don't know. I kept coming in, and they fortunately hung on to me. And I was ready to graduate. Oh, I should say this. So at Talbot, they make you take a lot of tests. You know, you pay a lot of money, and they want to see what they're working with. You know, have you damaged yourself with any of the stuff you've done? Are there other things to contend with, other mental issues they should be aware of? All good stuff to know. So they did all this testing on me, and they said, we have the results of your tests. I said, all right. They said, you need to be aware you have four distinct things that you have to contend with that, frankly, most others don't. Altogether, anyway. I said, all right, well, what's that? And they said, well, first off, you're 23 years old, Paul. You need to know statistically, young people, they just don't get sober. See, between being so young, they haven't experienced as much of life and maybe not lost as much, so they don't think they have a problem. And they traditionally struggle with relating to all of the older people in the rooms from a fellowship standpoint. So statistically, they don't make it. I said, okay. He said, secondly, they mentioned that other stuff I was doing in addition to alcohol, and they say people that smoke that stuff don't get sober. The level of physiological dependence is so extreme, they usually don't have a hard time getting sober. I said, okay. They say, thirdly, you have a very strong case of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that's why I tried to justify snorting Ritalin, because I'm like, I'm legitimately prescribed it because I legitimately have this condition. It's up to me how I put it in my body. If you prescribe it to me and I pay for it, mind your business. The rest of it's up to me. And, you know what I mean? If I want to put an aspirin in my butt, no one should mess with me about it. It's like the same kind of, you're right? It's nobody's business. I have a medical need. It's validated. But they said people with ADHD don't get sober statistically because there's such a high level of impulsivity, acting without thinking. And a traditional challenge with focusing and following through on tasks, usually people with ADHD statistically don't get sober. And they said the last thing is, you show strong traits of a narcissistic personality. I said, do tell. I'd never heard that word before in my entire life. And they said, well, you know, it's a spectrum. So you're not high on the spectrum with all the stuff that, you know, but there are two traits that really show up strongly for you in your personality testing. I said, what is that? And they said, one, you show a very strong sense of entitlement and a feeling that you're special and the rules don't apply to you. And I said, well, I am and they don't. But what's I still understand this word that you're using. What is this word you're talking about? And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, look, I come from an area, you know, I said, in Virginia, where everybody knows my family and my last name. And I said, I found that I've been entitled to get things that others are denied. I said, as far as being special and the rules not applying to me, I find that I have been able to talk my way out of most things that I get myself in trouble with or talk others into letting the rules not apply to me or just doing my own thing and not being challenged. So I said, I'm not delusional. This is how I've lived my life and it served me. And they go, well, how well has it served you? You're here, you know? And they go, look, Paul, people that have those traits statistically don't get sober because they don't think they have to deign to do the things that we do in recovery to get sober because they think they're different and they're better. And that's, you can't get sober with that. Look, most people have a hard time getting sober without any of these additional things. Obviously, some people have these things. It's rare to see all four of those things together. Statistically, with all four of those additional things, you have less than 0.5% chance of getting any kind of sobriety. So you don't have to be a statistic, but it's our responsibility to tell you the particulars of your situation and leave it to you to decide what you want to do. And I tell that story a lot, and I have people go, yeah, but you told them I want to show you. Not at all. I had no idea what to do with that information. I was still reeling. I didn't know what I was doing there. I mean, I was just still trying to figure out, you know, how to put my shoes on, so to speak. I didn't know what I was doing. And my life hasn't been gravy. I'll tell you, I've had people say, oh, man, and they should have. Man, you got sober at 23. Your life's going to be incredible. Man, I wish I got sober when I was your age. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do it all right. I'm going to do it all right, because I saw people and their careers were destroyed and their kids hated them and they were multiple divorces and I didn't want all that wreckage. So I can feel good about saying I've got 21 years sober. But I've lost jobs. I'm divorced. I've made some poor decisions in recovery than I've made using. Yeah. But I'm sober. My kids love me. I help people. I think the biggest compliment I've ever had in my entire life, and I bet the guy that did it felt completely innocuous about it. There was a guy I sponsored for like 2 months that was in a treatment center, 2-3 months. He ended up friending me on Facebook. And you know, on Facebook on your birthday, everybody says happy birthday to you and stuff. I was so touched. This guy on my birthday 1 year just said, my life is better because you were born. That's what recovery can do for us. The places that we can come from, and it's just mind-boggling that God can use someone like me in a way like that. So, I was ready to graduate from Talbot, and they said, "Easy, Tiger." I said, "Yeah, I want to go to your 3/4-way housing," and they said, "We don't think you're mature enough yet to graduate." And they said, "We're going to send you to Wilderness Treatment Center in Kalispell, Montana." And they said, "It's for boys 14 to 24. You just made the cutoff." And they go, "But if you do that, you'll get our good graces to come to our 3/4-way house." So I said, "All right." So I went to Kalispell, Montana. And it was interesting. It was like Outward Bound meets recovery. So we would like climb a mountain and then sit on the mountain and do a group. And there was a point we did an 11-day hiking excursion in Glacier National Park, 40 miles south of the Canadian border. And we saw like the Lewis and Clark cabin. And the most curious thing about that situation, they set us off on a 4-day solo mission in the middle of that. So that, here's what solo mission means. You're by yourself. You stay here. Don't leave here. Here's a water source. You got your sleeping bag. Here's a big, you know, Ziploc freezer bag full of Chex Mix. We're checking you once a day to make sure you're not eaten by a bear. Here's a big book, a pad of paper, and a pen. You have 4 days to write a 4-step. Okay. So, captive audience for that. It was actually kind of neat, but it was different. So I came back, I went into 3/4, and I was working and living, and, I met a girl, and, met a lot of girls. I remember one point sitting in the back of the Triangle Club going, man, I have been with 6 girls in this room. My sponsor's like, he's like, okay, from now on, you don't talk to any women. You sit in the very front of the room by the desk. You don't hug them. If they hug you, it's neck and shoulders, none of this full body stuff. He really gave me all the rules, you know? And so I stayed out past curfew in my 3/4-way situation, and they sent me to St. Jude's. Anybody been to St. Jude's? It's a far cry from the country club environment of which Talbot could be compared, let's say. And so, yeah, I was in Jude's for 3 months, and that hit me sideways. You know, no car, you got to eat their food, you know, you have to walk everywhere. It was just a very humbling experience. But that's where I met my sponsor, Jay. And Jay was a friend of this workshop for many years. And I saw him at a heavy hitters meeting. It was the only one heavy hitters meeting I've ever been to. And he spoke on sponsorship, and he had a glow, and I wanted what he had. And I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah, are you willing to do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it? He said, we're going to do something very few people do in a 12-step program. I said, what's that? He said, we're going to work all 12 steps. I said, oh. I thought he was kidding. Came to understand that that's, yeah, it's kind of like that, right? And so I was like, all right. And so he did. He took me through the steps, you know, and we went through and we talked about what it meant to turn my life over to God. And, you know, I remember thinking of it like a prism downspout where, like, if I'm to do God's will, I think of like a downspout on a gutter, you know, and they get clogged with pine needles and pine cones and maybe a dead bird and, you know, just different stuff. And I think of when I say that third step prayer, it's like this giant pipe cleaner from heaven pushes out all this garbage, all of the self-hatred, all of the loathing, all of the shame, all of the selfishness. And like the third step prayer says, not for my glory, but to show others how great you are. Because only if my vessel's clear can I have them come down and out through me to help other people. And then the formal cleaning of all the crap is 4 through 9. And when I did my fourth step with Jay, you know, he had me write down all my stuff, and he had me write down a list of, in our 12 and 12, in the fourth step, it says we made a list of assets and liabilities. And he says it's a moral inventory, not an immoral inventory. And he said, for every character defect you want God to remove when we get to the sixth step, because that's what you're preparing for at the end of 5, I want you to write a character asset. So I said, okay. And that was hard for me. That was really hard for me. And I was a guy that could be really cocky and what have you. But to really say something I believe that was good about me was really tough. And we do, bless his heart, a 6 or 8 hour four step at Lake Lanier. And he said, all right, pull out your list and read it to me. And I said, well, I guess I can be kind, I can be gentle, I can be giving, and I forget, just different things. And it was just uncomfortable for me. And then it was easy to say the defects. Oh, you know, lustful, vain, arrogant, judgmental, impatient. And he said, what do you think I'm going to tell you about these lists? And I said, well, I guess these defects, that's who I am now. But by working this program, I have these little seeds of this good stuff that I can grow into. He said, no. He said, the good stuff, he goes, that's who you are now. It's who you've always been. And it's who I've seen every time I've seen you ever since I've met you. He said, Paul, these defects are what you do. These assets are what you are. They're who you are. He said, everything you've been looking for your whole life, in women, in alcohol and drugs, everything outside, even everything you've been looking for in AA, has been inside you this entire time. And I said, well, why didn't you tell me that when I got here? You saved me a lot of time. And he said, no, because you wouldn't have believed it. He said, you see, nothing can take the place of you doing the work in this program to discover that through what the steps provide. And he said, all we're doing is taking this pure child to God that is covered in the muck and the gunk and of the shame and the self-loathing and the regret and the hatred and the anger and the fear. And we're hosing all that guy, we're hosing that little guy off to say, this is you and this is what we've always been. We're here to take off. It's like when they asked Michelangelo how he carved the sculpture of David. He says, it's easy. I just carved away the parts that weren't the man. And he said, that's what we're doing here in recovery. That's what we're doing with the step work. And then I wanted to date. And I'd been dating. Like I said, women have been an issue for me. But I wanted to date and not be in trouble. You know, I mean, I had that official year. And I said, hey, it reminds me of the joke of the guy that goes to his sponsor. He says, hey, I got a year. Can I date? And the sponsor goes, no, you can't date. He goes, oh, come on. Why not? He goes, because you're married, you idiot. So, anyway, if you can relate to that, thermometer, anybody? All right. So I was like, I want to date. And Jay was so great with these sponsor assignments. There's always a trick, but, you know, you just have to go with it. And he said, you want a date? Okay, I want you to make a list of everything you want in a partner. I said, I get to pick? He said, yeah. And I knew it was a trick, but I mean, it was good at the front end. So I was like, I'll follow this through. So he said, write down every trait you want out of a partner. And I was like, man, this is cool. You know, you just kind of see what's out there and you pick something out and you see what you're working with. I never thought of it from coming up with a list. So there were all these things down that I was looking for. And so I got with him on my list. And he said, read me what you wrote down. And I wrote down a variety of very superficial things. But I also wrote, you know, someone that is kind and non-judgmental and spiritual and at peace and patient and always doing for the other person. I also wanted someone that was beautiful and didn't know it, because I was high maintenance enough for a relationship, you know, and I want somebody that knew it that I'm going to have to try to really work to keep. And anyway, but I had all this stuff, okay? And so he said, what do you think I'm going to tell you? And I said, you're going to tell me that I built up this perfect person that doesn't exist. And he said, no, Paul, I've asked you to capture assets, traits that you would like. There are going to be defects, things you don't want. I ask you to focus on what you want. There are women out there that have all these traits. And I kind of lit up. I said, okay. He said, but the question I have to ask you is this. How many of these characteristics do you have? He said, you see, Paul, if you want that, you can have that. But to get that, you've got to be that. So no, you can't date. And I was like, he's like, no, you're saying this is what you want. And he showed me how in the big book on the fourth step, it says we made a list. We came up with a sane, sound sex ideal with which God was to mold and sculpt for our future partner. He said, so now you've come up with that. And so now what we have to do is get you to where you're worthy of someone like this. And you pray to put God for God to put this person in your life. And I was upset because I didn't want to do that. I would have sandbagged the list. You know what I mean? I'd have put that list on a diet. And been like, do I have this? So, but it was good. And I'll tell you, I met somebody that was all that everything on that list and more. And we were married for 12 years and we had 3 children. And it was a gift. And she was things I didn't even know to write down. And that was a real blessing. So, anyway, so I'm doing this deal. I'm living in Atlanta. And I, you know, it's really bothering me about the way things panned out with VMI. And I'm really wanting to go back. And so I called in and said, I'd like to see if I could come back to VMI. And they gave me the things I would need to do to petition to come back. And so I moved back to Virginia within a 2-week period. I enrolled in colleges at a college in Virginia close to where my parents lived and moved in with them. And I started petitioning to go back. And the funniest thing happens, you know, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. I remember going to a meeting and I saw a guy once there, and I shared about my situation, and he came up after the meeting. He goes, I was the honor corps president in my class, and I was the battalion commander and the captain of the swim team. I'd love to write you a letter of recommendation to help you with your case. I was like, oh, okay, great. And these things were just happening for me, you know. And I remember Bob, who's here, was sponsoring me back then, my buddy Bob from Virginia. And it was cool. And I tell you what, I got to go to VMI, and I got to sit down in front of those people. And there were 3 people petitioning to go back in. One guy brought an attorney. And they'd all read my case. You know, I've been preparing it for months. And I was able to say this without trying to do any kind of manipulation or, you know, finagling. And I said, look, I have straight A's now. I can go anywhere I want. But it really would mean a lot to come back and finish here. And I look forward to your decision. And that was it. And you know what was really powerful? December 4th, 1996, I had a razor blade to my wrist. Exactly 3 years to the date, December 4th, 1999, I got the phone call the next day from meeting with the Board of Visitors at VMI. And Colonel Leroy Hammond said, congratulations, pack your bags, we'll see you in January. That's what God does for people in this program. You know, when I got to go back and I got to be a member of this fellowship, and you know, it's funny, and I didn't even get demerits, and it wasn't even hard. You know, I used to struggle to just not be in trouble. I didn't know how other people did it. And but it was cool. I got to show. It was funny. One guy came up to me once and he goes, man, I remember you from before, because those guys were first years when I was supposed to be a senior. Well, I was. And then they were all now seniors or first classmen, as we called them, when I came back. And this guy goes, man, you're different from before. I said, yeah. And I remember him sitting down with me. He's like, man, do you think you could help me? And I'm trying to talk to this guy like we do, right? But something was a little bit off, and I couldn't quite figure it out. And he was sweating, and I'm like, are you okay? And he goes, I just ate a bunch of mushrooms a couple hours ago. And I was like, you go get some rest. Come see me tomorrow. And, you know, and he did. And that happened with a couple different people, and that was really neat. Because, see, that's the thing with this deal. I was telling somebody the other night, it's so tragic to me in life where, in AA, where we have people, our book says AA is the last house on the block. And I've seen it happen over the years, and it pains me to know that it happens everywhere. And I've had a sponsor tell me years ago that, hey, he didn't need a crusader. But it really hurts me that people come into the rooms and they do meetings and the meetings don't work. And they go back out and they say, I tried A and it didn't work for me. And they die. And if they were on a lie detector, it would read true. And so there's a difference between the fellowship and the program. The fellowship's fantastic, and you can't have one without the other. But the fellowship's where I feel good. It's where I see people. It's where I get my comrades, my brothers in arms. I get people where I talk about the things that I've done, the ways that I've felt that don't make any sense. And they make sense to people like me, and it makes me feel good. But real recovery is what we do between meetings. Real recovery is working the steps. I heard a speaker one time say that I really liked, said, it's like getting a scratch-off lottery ticket, and there's 12 things you scratch off, and every single ticket's a $1 million winner. But you got to scratch off the 12 things and keep living your life by that. And people die because they went to some meetings. You know, think of a guy I know that talks about working at a treatment center and seeing a guy show up again at, you know, his next treatment center going, oh, man, and seeing the steps on the wall going, not this stuff. He goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, I tried A and it didn't work. And he says, he wraps his arm around the shoulder and says, okay, well, let's look at these steps here. So you admitted you were powerless. You turned your life over to God and believed he'd help you. You started living your life the way God would have you live it every day. Okay. You did all your resentments and fears and sex harms, and you shared all of that with another human being, another guy. And then you asked God to remove all your defects that caused all that wreckage. And then you made amends to anyone you've ever harmed, ever. And then you started living your life like this every single day. And you prayed and meditated all the time. And you sponsored other men and took them through all this work, and it still didn't work for you? No, I didn't do any of that stuff. I just went to some meetings. It's like, well, then you didn't do AA. And I think it's really tragic. And I've seen a lot of people die. And I feel lucky that we're here. And I heard it one time said, and I'm not really gloomy in my story, but I heard it one time said, when you trudge the road to happy destiny, you have to step over the bodies. And I don't like doing it. And I'm so grateful to be here. And if I can find somebody, and if they felt like me and they've done like me and I can help them, I just hope they let me, because they don't have to. But we get to be here and we get to stay sober by trying. And that's the gift. You think about history of time, you know, back what they did. This is like a funnel. If you think about the history of recorded time and pre-recorded time, people like us, we ended up in jail. We were like back in the days of medieval times, you know, like the village fool. That was us. That was people like us. People dying in the streets, people they put in loony bins. That was our people. And in 1935, think of how much mankind existed from dinosaurs on. And then 1935, this thing came out. And then the people that came to it and learned about it was a smaller sect. And then the people that actually stayed and continued to do the work was a smaller set. And then as we go through, think about all the people that need to be here that aren't here. When I used to go to meetings in Atlanta, they used to say, this program is not for people who need it. If it was, we'd hold meetings in Turner Stadium. And then I heard it say it's for people that want it. And then I heard it said, no, it's only for people that want it. There are people that want it that won't do the work. It's for people that do it. And so if you think about the people down here to the people that actually do the work and stay doing the work, it's this tiny sliver, this tiny crucible, this drip that comes out, this precious piece of humanity that we get to be a part of, to get saved from all of that hurt and all of that pain and all of that shame and all of that loss, to be able to contribute. There's gratitude in that. You know, I'm going to tell you, I moved back. I stayed in Virginia. I got out of BMI. I started working. I got married. You know, I met a girl. And you know, I'll tell you, I met this girl that I married. And AA became my identity. It was a big part of my identity. And on our third date, I said, I'm going to take you to something I'm a part of. I said, it's real important before I share this with you. This is not something that I do. This isn't a club. This is an integral part of who I am as a man and as a human being. And if you're okay with that, let's continue to see where this develops. And if you're not okay, then that's all right, too. Let's figure that out before we get too emotionally entangled. And I took her to an AA meeting, you know, because I was taught this is a non-negotiable. And so, you know, she became a part of that with me. And we, like I said, we had a family. And it was so interesting because, you know, I think about the way things come full circle. And Jay was my sponsor, and I remember when he came to pick me up for a meeting when I was at Jude's. It was our first time getting together after asking him to sponsor me. And he had this carpenter's van, anybody that knew him. And I went to climb in the passenger seat. I'm just trying to make small talk. It's our first time getting together, you know. And I said, "So how was your day?" He goes, "It was all right. Not great." I said, "What happened?" He goes, "I lost my job, and I got really uncomfortable." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry." He goes, "It's fine." I goes, "Like, what are you going to do?" He's like, "What do you mean? I'll just get another job. I was looking for a job, and I got that one. Come on, get in the car. Let's go to a meeting." And I'm like, "Oh, my God. Oh." You know what I mean? Like, the coping skills. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, I had no coping skills. Like, I felt like I had to call 911 when I ran out of toilet paper. You know what I mean? And this guy's losing a job and just being like, "I got this." And it's funny how things come full circle. 10 years later, I lost a job. I was devastated by it. I worked for the company for 10 years. So I guess it was almost 15 years later. And I was having a hard time. And I picked up a new sponsee at the VA. And I went to pick him up. And he said the same thing. "How was your day?" And I was like, "I've had better. I just lost my job." And he looked really uncomfortable. And he said, "We can do this another time." I was like, "Oh, you don't understand. This is exactly what I need to be doing right now." But I have had a tough time. You know, I was moving around the country, and what I do, I'm a professional speaker and trainer, and I love it. And, you know, it's my jam, and used to do some stage acting. It's a good fit for me, but, you know, there's not a lot of stability in the function. And so, you know, losing jobs and worrying about taking care of my family and my kids, and, you know, and it was tough. And moving different places around the country for work. And I mean, it was a real struggle. It was a lot of challenges with that. And, but you know, always staying sober, always doing the deal. And going back to the program of recovery, I sometimes talk about it like when you think about where you spend your time in recovery, not to be snake charmed into meetings only sobriety. Because it doesn't have the staying power. And I think, anybody know what Meetup is? It's okay if you don't. It's an app or a website where you just can find people with similar interests. You want to find a group to go hiking with? Get on the app. There are lots of hiking groups. Want to find a dating group? Want to find a spiritual meditation group? Want to find people that are dog lovers? Whatever. Let's say I want big muscles. And I find a meetup group of weightlifters. And I go, "Man, I'm going to be huge." And I go to this meeting. And these guys are, they're hulks, man. They're all sitting in a circle. And I'm going to take some notes. And I hear these guys, you know, when they're in this meeting talking about weightlifting technique. And the best places to go to the gym. And maybe some supplements to take. And a good diet, and I'm going, "Man, I'm going to be a beast." And I'm taking all these notes. And I keep going to these meetup meetings with these weightlifters. And after a while, I go, "Man, this doesn't work. This doesn't work at all. But I haven't gotten in the gym. That's AA." You know what I mean? Recovery is what takes place between meetings. And let's say I do go to the gym. It takes a long time to get big. It hurts. And you're sore. And you're going, "I don't know that I want to do this." That's AA. And so I got to make sure I'm clear on what it takes to do this and to be this. And so, you know, doing these things is just kind of interesting the way that it comes through. So I'm trying to see, am I balancing it with going to meetings and doing the fellowship and then doing a program of recovery with working steps and doing these other things. But it's funny the way things show up. Like, I remember there was a guy who had, I don't know, I guess he had 10 years sober. And I was home from treatment on a therapeutic leave. And I was at a meeting, and everybody in that meeting, I don't think it was any, at least from what I could tell, there's nobody in there under the age of 60. And the oldest person and I was probably in their 80s. And I'm there at 23 years old on a bit break from rehab going, "Is this what my life is destined to become? Is this now my new social jam?" And I was like, "I don't think I want to do this. All these old people, I can't relate to anybody. Like, I need to get out. I got to meet a woman to get married. I'm going to have to, like, you know, make career inroads and all that. And I got to do this. I don't think this is for me. I know I can't do alcohol and drugs, but I just don't think this is the answer." And I remember leaving that meeting right after the prayer. And I guess there was a younger guy because I missed him. He caught me. He ran out and grabbed me. He said, "Man," he goes, "I'm 33 years old." He said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 23. He said, "I got here at 23, and I got 10 years sober, and this program's incredible, and it's going to change your life." He goes, "I am so excited that you're here. Man, keep coming back. Man, you are just in for such a treat." And I just thought, "Huh. All right, well, maybe I'll just keep coming around." And, you know, God just puts these things in place. I remember when I was in rehab, this guy who was an attorney that was a friend of His wife was a friend of my mother's. She didn't really know the man, but I got a subpoena to go to court for some alcoholic thing I was involved in. And and so she called this man instead of our family attorney. And even she will say she doesn't know why she called him. But she said, "We're having a hard time. Paul's dad's in the hospital. He's in treatment in Atlanta. I got the subpoena and I don't know what to do with it. Can you help me?" And you know what he said? He said, "Absolutely, Susan." He said, "I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 12 years and I'd be happy to help you and your son." You know, that's the kind of stuff that happens in recovery. And, but you know, the thing is with recovery, you got to look at it. It's the only thing in your life. It's the only thing in your life that you do and then see how it works versus figuring it out first. If you try to figure this thing out, it's never going to happen. So most things in life, you want to figure it out and then do it. So sometimes they compare it to like the opposite of scuba diving. Scuba diving is an extreme. Most things in life, you want to figure it out. You're smart. You were taught that way. You should have been taught that way. If I want to go scuba diving, and I go, "I know I'm supposed to take this test and watch these videos and practice in the swimming pool. I got it. Just give me the tank. Just give me the mask. Let's go. Let me just..." That's a very poor decision. You probably aren't going to make it, okay? Recovery is the only thing where, though, it is like that. We're like, "How does this work? What? This seems very paradoxical." It's like, just do the steps. Just trust us. Just do this. And then you can look back and say, "Okay, now it makes sense." Anybody here have kids? You remember before you had your first kid and people are like, "Oh man, you're going to have this feeling like your heart's going to explode and whatever." And you're trying to really drink it in like you're getting it. But were you even close though until when it actually happened? Did it even hold a candle, people's descriptions? Same thing in recovery. You just do it. Then you can look back and say, "Okay, now I get it." But anyway, but I'll tell you, you know, recovery's been interesting. I really had a hard time after my divorce. And, you know, looking at different things. And I've really had to kind of reinvent my life in a different way. And realizing that, you know, I saw something that said, the story that you're living may not be the story that you intended, but it's about living the story that you have. And I'm really grateful. I've had a lot of great opportunities. I get to travel all around the world as a professional speaker and trainer. I've got a lot of guys that care about me here and other places that as a result of this program. And I feel really fortunate that I've been given the opportunity to just be a small part of this thing. I wanted to finish up with a couple quick stories. One is about a story called The Man in the Hole. And, you know, I always picture this as a man in a hole. It's like it's a sewer manhole cover that's open and look down and the guy's down there. It's a metaphor for his alcoholism, you know, and he's getting desperate. And he's calling up for help. And a businessman comes by and he looks down and he says, "What's wrong?" And he's like, "Well, I can't stop drinking and I don't know what to do." He goes, "Well, if you can't stop drinking, don't you need to just go to rehab? Here's some money. Go to treatment." So the man goes to treatment, but he doesn't do what's recommended. He doesn't do what he's told. And when he gets home, he just goes back to what he's doing. So he stays drunk. So the next psychiatrist walks by and says, "Well, here, take some antidepressants." And I'm not knocking antidepressants. I take medicine for ADHD. I've taken antidepressants before. But if I ever think that they're the answer to alcoholism, I'm in trouble. And then the therapist comes by and says, "Lay on the couch, tell me about your mother." Nothing wrong with therapy. I've done therapy. I mean, treatment is one big therapy session. But, you know, nothing wrong with that. But if I think that's the answer to my disease of addiction, I'm not going to stay sober. Neither does this man. And then the priest comes by and says, "All you need to do is go to church. Just come to church with me, son." And he does. But as we know, our book says, faith without works is dead. So he stays drunk and he's getting desperate because our book says there comes a point in the alcoholic's life where many a man makes the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And it's talking about suicide. And I can tell you, I've been to some dark places in sobriety. Never to the point of that first time I told you about, but I can just tell you, life happens and sometimes it's hard. The man cries out one last time and he says, "Please, somebody help me." And the recovered alcoholic looks down into the manhole. And he says, "Oh yes, please, somebody please help me." He goes, "I can't stop drinking. I don't want to die, but I don't know how to live." And the recovered alcoholic jumps down in the hole beside him. And the man freaks out, you know. He goes, "Oh my God." He goes, "What are you doing?" He's like, "No, we're both screwed. Why would you even do that?" And the guy goes, "Shh." And he puts his hand on the man's shoulder. He says, "It's okay." He said, "You see, I've been here before and I know the way out." And that's what we do for each other in Alcoholics Anonymous. Last thing I'll share with you, to me, is where the third step and the 12th step come together. And it's a story called The Story About God and the Drunk. So a drunk approaches God and he says, "I want to get sober." And so God's heard these things from this guy before, you know. And he goes, he starts to mess with the guy. He goes, "Well, how much money you got on you?" And he goes, "Money?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I've got 50 bucks. He goes, God goes, "All right, for you sobriety is going to cost you 50 bucks. He goes, "Okay." And then he goes, "But if I give you my money, how will I be able to put gas in my car?" And God said, "Oh, you have a car. Well, if you want sobriety, it's going to cost you your car." And the man goes, "Okay." And he takes out his keys. He goes, "But if you take my car, how will I be able to go to work?" He says, "Oh, you have a job." "Okay, well, if you want sobriety, it's going to cost your job." And he goes, "But if you take my job, how will I be able to pay my mortgage?" And God says, "Okay, now you got a house. Now we're talking. So if you want sobriety, it's going to cost you your house." And the man's getting really scared now. And he says, "But if you take my house, where will I put my family?" He goes, "Oh, now you care about your family." He says, "If you want sobriety, it's going to cost your family." Man looks scared. He's really scared. And with the desperation, he says, "But God, if you take my family, all I'll have left is my life." And God furrows his brow. And he looks down on the man. He says, "That's right. And if you want sobriety, it's going to cost your life." And the man finally surrenders. And God says, "But I'll make a deal with you." He said, "I'll give you back your money, but it's not your money anymore. It's my money. And when you spend it, I want you to remember it's my money. You spend it the way I would spend it. Can you do that?" And the drunk says, "Uh-huh." And he said, "And I'll give you your car keys back, but it's not your car. It's my car. And you only take it to places I would drive if I were in the car with you. Will you do that deal?" And he says, "Uh-huh. It's okay." He said, and you can have that job, but you need to treat people at work the way you talk about treating people in those meetings you go to. Can you do that?" He says, "Okay." And then he says, "And I'll let you have that house back, but it can't be a house of neglect and holes punched in the wall and people screaming at each other. It needs to be a house of love. Can you do that?" And he says, "I'll give you back that family that you abused and neglected." But he said, "They're not your family anymore. They're my family. And don't you ever forget that." And I tell you, I pause at this part of the story tonight because I just still feel sad about my own marriage ending and my own family situation. But you know, that's on me and God. But you know, I got to remember this stuff and I got to talk about this stuff and we've got to hear this stuff. And finally he said, "I'll give you your life back, but it's not your life anymore. It's my life. But the blessing is, the beauty is, if you live your life the way I would have you live it, you will be able to get through anything in your life with grace and dignity. And it will be the most amazing experience you can ever have if you'll just trust me." And the drunk says, "Okay." And God says, "Come here and give me a hug." And he does. And with that, this is how sobriety makes me feel. That's all I have. Good night. Thank you.